Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. It's been 20 years since the peace accord was signed in Tajikistan, ending the 5 years bloody civil war. 20 years on since then, what is the legacy of the war and of the peace accord in today's Tajikistan? On today's Majlis, we have two simple questions to discuss: the war and its legacy, and peace accord and its implications, in the light of which we will also briefly touch upon current situation and the country's future. With this, let's welcome our guests today. From New York, I'm joined by Dr. Edward Lemon, a Tajikistan researcher and postdoctoral fellow at the Harriman Institute at Columbia University, Dr. Nowruz Nikhtbakhshoyev, a visiting scholar at the Russian and Eastern European Institute at Indiana University, Bruce Panier, editor of Qishloq Awazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, a blog on Central Asia. Welcome on board, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. Nowruz, let's start with you. Take us through the old days, early 90s, leading to the days when this war erupted. How was Tajikistan looked like then?
So it's now kind of become a narrative that, you know, the opposition forces, basically the civil war, kind of destroyed the country. And as if prior to the war, there weren't any contradictions or like political disagreements. But political disagreements were always there under the Soviet Union because of, you know, inequalities that the economic structure back then created. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, you had these different political movements that originated in different regions. They tried to kind of mobilize to air their grievances, and this polarization eventually escalated in the civil war that, you know, in 1992 you have basically the onset of this war that kind of lasted officially until 1997. So the basic participants in the war were main regional groupings, like you had all factions or clan-like organizations.
Yeah. Nowruz, let's get into that a little bit later. Before that, Edward, I want you to jump in here. Nowruz just led us to the way things have started. What was the tipping point which led to this eruption of this full-scale civil war?
Yes, so you had these two sort of situations in the spring of 1992 where you had two opposing camps of protesters. One group of whom sort of supported the incumbent government under Rahman Nabiev, supported sort of the continuance of the status quo, and they were supported by these sort of groups from Kulob and from Leninabad, which is now Khujand, so the north of the country, which had been the sort of dominant force in, you know, Republican politics. So you had those on the one hand, and on the other hand, you had a sort of loose coalition of people who were calling for a sort of Islam to play a greater role in the state, those who were calling for a more democratic, open government, people from the Pamir and people from Agam, east of the country. And really, accounts differ, but the seeming spark for the onset of violence was the arming of the pro-government protesters by the government itself in May 1992. Now, some accounts say that the opposition themselves at that point were already armed and they responded violently themselves. Other people say that it was the, you know, the pro-government forces that started. But either way, basically in May 1992, you had a situation where armed struggle sort of ensued.
Okay, Bruce, now fighting has started. What happened in the war?
Well, Edward covered, and Nowruz too, kind of how it started. And there was a lot of different things in play that had already been there. You know, another one was that during the years of certainly the last two decades, when Tajikistan was part of the Soviet Union, they had a program where they had moved people around in the country. So they had taken them out of their traditional areas of the country and moved them to other areas, mostly for agricultural purposes. But it also had the effect of like kind of breaking down any kind of tribalism or you know, sense of ancient community or something like that. So when, you know, when everything started to fall apart, then these divisions like came to the surface. People were resentful that they'd had other groups come into what they considered their land and settled there, and they tried to kick them out forcibly. And so you ended up, the two groups, the anti-government group became the United Tajik Opposition. It was the Islamic Renaissance Party, the Democratic Party of Tajikistan, Lale Badakhshan. There was a couple other groups that were involved in this too. And they were were pushed out away from the capital, but they reformed, especially in the mountains east of Tajikistan, and that started the war. Now, Rahman wasn't the president at that time. In fact, they went through, after Nabiyev, it had, I think, two other people before they finally got to Rahman. But the government was in a pretty weak position. They could count somewhat on the Russian troops that were still there in the country, the 201st Division and Russian border guards that were along the border, but Moscow really didn't want to get involved in this. And I don't think that the feeling in Moscow was that this would get so out of hand as it did. So the Tajik government had to rely on other groups to support them. At first, they became this group called the Popular Front, and they had their own militias. And they're actually the ones that ended up putting Rahman in power at the end of 1992. So you had this mixture of all kinds of people with all kinds of different really goals and motivations in Tajikistan, some that were dispossessed or felt they had been marginalized, and they kind of gravitated toward the opposition forces, and then some who were sort of opportunists, I suppose, who gave kind of vague oaths to help the government out. In the meantime, they kind of carried out their own local policies. I mean, Sangak Safarov, for instance, is an infamous figure. He had so much power for a while until he was killed by one of his own deputies, that he could pretty much order around the Tajik government as he wanted. And there were other figures throughout the civil war who took this, who had that similar roles, where they had accumulated so much power that they were actually able to dictate policy to the government in Dushanbe, you know, well after Rahman had been installed in a position of leadership. So, you know, a variety of interests, old vendettas, there was all kinds of things just kind of came together. And you know, as we heard, Tajikistan was not in great economic shape to start with. So once the civil war started, everything just seemed to fall apart. There was knock-on effects all over the place on the health system, the education system, everything, especially in the mountains just to the east of Dushanbe, 80-100 kilometers or something. It just turned into a meat grinder where they fought and fought, and weapons seemed to be in great supply, so there was no way to really stop them. Despite numerous efforts at ceasefires and peace talks that started in 1994, it just kind of went on and on.
Tens of thousands of people killed, obviously. How bad the war was? Bruce, Nowruz, jump in. Feel free. It's an open question.
I'll let Nowruz go.
Yeah, I mean, these figures are staggering. Like, you know, I mean, it's an official account. You know, it's like 100,000, and so many people were displaced. I mean, it's generally, you know, the legacies will be felt throughout, because you have a generation, next generation, that, you know, maybe lost their parents, and it created massive, you know, social dislocations. And then the psychological scar of the war is still there. At least that's what I know through my fieldworks research. I mean, they tried to kind of keep it to themselves, all these pressures, but given that there wasn't really a Truth and Reconciliation Commission of sorts that we observed in other post-conflict societies, and then people tend to deal with it, to cope with it. But I mean, even though it's a purely private psychological issue, I think the social issues continue to be felt. Like I said, you have a generation who grew up without, you know, parents, and you have single-parent households exacerbated by rural out-migration as well.
Finally, after 5 years of this disastrous war, the war ended. Tell us, please, Edward, how did this happen?
So, yeah, so after the most intense fighting had finished in 1993, the war did drag on for another 4 years. And there were numerous efforts, as Bruce said, at sort of brokering ceasefires. But there are a number of sort of commanders who continued to sort of resist efforts to be brought to the sort of negotiation table. And in the end, sort of the peace accord was signed after a sort of process of shuttle diplomacy involving the UN, involving Russia, and involving Iran. Sort of Russia sort of pressurizing Rahman to sort of end the conflict and sort of negotiate with the opposition. Whereas Iran sort of obviously was pressurizing the United Tajik opposition because they had closer links with Iran. So yeah, so it was sort of a process by which both parties sort of ran out of steam in many ways, and peace became probably in both parties' interests, and they were supported by outside powers.
Can I jump in with one more comment,
yeah,
too?
Sure.
Because, yeah, I mean, certainly the big powers that were trying to broker the peace, that being Moscow and Tehran, were both pushing them. But another catalyst toward the peace process was the capture of Kabul by the Taliban in late September 1996, too, which really kind of got got activity going a lot faster again, because remember, we had, by that time, there was certainly tens of thousands of Tajik refugees that had crossed the border into Afghanistan. Even the Islamic Renaissance Party, the main wing of the United Tajik Opposition, didn't have very good contacts with the Taliban and didn't support their particular style of Islam either. And there was a lot of fears in Moscow and certainly among the other Central Asian states that as the Taliban were advancing north, that this was the bigger problem. And it was time to solve the Tajik civil war, because something worse was coming from the south already. So that was another element that kind of drove the parties at the peace table to try to reach some kind of agreement as quickly as they could.
As per my humble understanding, I think the opposition parties, first and foremost the Islamic Party, they also failed to show the strength. I mean, their objective was take over the regime. They couldn't do that. What was the reason of their failure? Why did they fail to take over the regime, if that was the intention?
Well, I mean, it's a political climate in Tajikistan. I mean, it emerged from the collapse of the former Soviet Union, 75 years under the Soviet Union. You cannot assume that the entire society has become sympathetic to Islamic cause. I mean, the political party had its own like power base in certain regions, but that didn't necessarily translate into the entire country. With that being said, I mean, obviously, it's really hard to judge with any sense of accuracy the exact level of support each particular party had, because of this, elections in Tajikistan, fraudulent elections are basically the norm rather than the exception. But if you talk about its ongoing failures to consolidate itself, I mean, it has to do with government, manipulation of elections, with government, repressive tactics, but also, the inability of the opposition party to kind of constantly be in touch with its base. It seems to me that they got too complacent over time, once, especially certain factions of the opposition, they got too tempted to join the government and then kind of got disconnected. But as far as for the leadership of the Islamic Party, I think they also became too complacent, and they didn't want to upset the status quo. And the status quo was that they were a buffer between the regime and the extremist wing of the opposition. So they always kind of tried to portray themselves as this vital buffer. And the status quo was in their best interest. And you could actually get that sense from multiple statements by the leadership of this political party, of the Islamic political party, that we are here for patience, we are here for the stability of the nation. For us, the sovereignty of the nation is all that counts. I mean, it wasn't about promoting democracy, or it was about preserving the statehood and making sure that, the country doesn't slide back to violence. So the status quo was in their favor, and probably that's one of the reasons why it didn't gain traction in the imagination of most of its followers, who wanted more radical action, more radical in the sense of taking bolder political steps. And maybe they became more disenchanted. And actually, one of the greatest outcomes that actually defied the expectations of many analysts was that right after right after the political party was banned, nothing really happened. So the expectation was that once, the regime closed down the political party, you would expect, massive riots and revolts, because, the only official outlet has been shut, but nothing happened. Basically, the regime is still in place and there's no trace of any political activity. So it goes to say, in my opinion, that part of the reason is that we tried to treat this Islamic Revival Party as a monolith, as a monolith unit, which it wasn't. I think disagreements and discords within the party to some extent prevented it from becoming a viable political party capable of taking the reins of government, in addition to government suppression.
Edward, maybe you would like to comment on this, the reason of the failure of the opposition party then to take over the government. What was that?
Yeah, I think if we're talking about during the civil war itself, I guess as Matt Cruz has just said, I think it was the fact that firstly, as Amber said, they couldn't sort of generate enough sort of popular support. Their support bases were largely amongst the Ghani population, which, doesn't form a majority in the country. They had some support in certain parts of the north of the country, Isfara, for example, but they didn't really have enough support. At the same time, Popular Front, the government, pro-government forces, enjoyed the support of Uzbekistan and Russia, as well as having their own militias. So, if we're talking about militarily at the time, United Tajik opposition was sort of pushed into Afghanistan and then had to sort of launch sporadic attacks from there from sort of 1993 onwards. So they were sort of ready on the back foot by then. And subsequently, as Navruz has said, they've sort of, and I guess we'll discuss this in more detail, they've sort of suffered from repeated sort of government repression and have continued to sort of struggle to define themselves.
Yeah.
And struggle to sort of shake off the identity of being a sort of Islamist, violent Islamist opposition, as they were during the Civil War. And they've struggled to sort of carve themselves out a sort of legitimate space in Tajik politics.
Hmm. Okay, before to end the first part of the discussions, so war ended after 5 years, Bruce. If anyone came out victorious from this disaster, that person is Rahmon. He jumped from a minor position to lead the country, and here you go, after 20 years, he's still in power. So what role did he play in ending the war?
Well, his role as it's described now is far more than yeah. I remember it being at the time. Now he did go and actually meet one-on-one with the leader of the UTO, Saeed Abdullah Nouri, on occasions when talks backed down. But Rahmon, for instance, was not really part of the negotiating team that went to meet with UTO officials, only on a few occasions. You know, that said, he went to Afghanistan to meet with Nouri in, I think, late December 1996, for instance. So he was willing to take some chances to try to push the peace process forward. But there were a lot of actors in this, and that's why, like I said, when I see the news articles now from state media about, you know, Rahmon, you know, Peshwai, Mili, and all the great things that he did, you know, I was covering it. I was in Central Asia in 1992 and 3, although rarely in Tajikistan for obvious reasons of this conversation. And then, of course, I started writing about it, you know, in 1995. And I don't remember him having an extremely prominent role in any of these peace negotiations. In fact, you know, I mean, certainly in 1995, 1996, maybe even early 1997, it was probably, you know, an even bet that he wasn't going to make it very much longer. It was a pretty weak government. It was hard to say that he was actually the sole person in command of the country. He took advice, or was forced to take advice, from a number of other actors, not only Russia and to some extent Iran, but I mean even within his own government and some of his more odious allies from these Popular Front paramilitary groups. So you know, I do give him credit that there was some times when he had to go out and meet with some people that probably would rather have not gone and met with at all. But as far as being like extremely active in promoting the peace process, he left a lot of that stuff to other people in his government. And I know he's taken a lot of the credit for it now, but I remember the day they signed the peace deal and the months leading up to that. And he was one of many, many actors that were involved in that.
Thanks. Yes, the war was bloody, disastrous, whether fair or unfair. It ended with a peace accord. And now we are marking 20th anniversary of the accord. We will continue the discussion talking about the legacy of peace accord and today's Tajikistan shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast. We are discussing 20th anniversary since end of the civil war in Tajikistan. Joining me in the discussion are Dr. Edward Lemon, a Tajikistan researcher and postdoctoral fellow at the Harriman Institute of Columbia University, Dr. Nouroz Nikt Bakhshoyev, visiting scholar at the Russian and Eastern European Institute at Indiana University, Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's blog on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Okay, so let's talk about peace accord. Walk us through, Nouroz, the process on how the document was signed and what was the main conditions of the accord.
It's a really complicated piece of agreement that basically the major components was the repatriation of the refugees and then the reintegration of the United Tajik opposition forces into the government, into the military, I guess government in quotations at the time, and also, you know, a political power sharing agreement according to which 30% of the ministerial you know, post the cabinets was supposed to go to the political members of the United Tajik opposition. So, I mean, these three complicated tasks, you know, in a post-war country, in a country that was amidst the civil war still, there were a lot of challenges to actually accomplishing all of these tasks. And one can say for sure that, you know, the spirit of all these agreements were kind of violated in one way or another, but the government generally succeeded in repatriating the refugees, I mean, together with the opposition forces and the international actors, such as the UN observer mission. And because as a result of the civil war, just to reiterate, thousands and thousands, hundreds and thousands of people like sought refuge in Afghanistan, they were displaced. So they had to be brought back. And there were a lot of disagreements, obviously, between the opposition and the government, because it was at that point, it was in the best interest of the United Tajik opposition to kind of have these displaced people in Afghanistan as a potential power base from which to recruit. And then realizing that the government actually then began to kind of facilitate the repatriation, because there was also a condition that, you know, these there will be an amnesty, you know, they will be freed from criminal prosecution. By and large, the refugee component of these agreements had a relative success. The military, there were also challenges, and these United Tajik opposition forces kind of were like stationed in different places, you know, as consolidated units without being like interspersed with the Popular Front troops. So over time, they also kind of, their reintegration took place, especially in the integration actually succeeded a lot in forces that were in charge of the border control, because I guess the unified cause was to protect the borders, you know, from Taliban and other external aggressors. The political, you know, agreement, according to which 30% of ministerial posts had to go to the opposition. At higher levels, I think it reached success. You know, we do see like opposition figures like Mirzo Zyoyev became the Ministry of Emergency, and Bajak Bartura Jonzoda became the Deputy Vice President. So by and large, at the top level, at the national level, the political power sharing arrangement was implemented. But it was at the bottom, mid-level, you know, regional level, district levels, that it ran into a lot of challenges. So with the passage, in retrospect, one can say that, you know, this power sharing agreement was completely violated, because, you know, all the progress that was made was rolled back. And in a sense that gradually the government was able to sideline members of the opposition and to remove them or all positions. And this is the outcome of the agreement, that you have now a field that's completely dominated by members of the government. Mm. Even my interviews with members of the Islamic Party, they noted that it was before they were actually banned. They noted one of the weaknesses of the United Tajik opposition by pointing out that the reason why they got sidelined, because they were too tempted, you know, to get government jobs. And we are much more successful because we didn't get tempted. We instead formed our political party, which is disconnected from the government. So at the time, they were very assured that they're going to continue to preserve their power, even as an independent political party, which didn't come to be. So by and large, we can say that the power sharing agreement, in spirit, it was violated completely, and there's no trace of it right now.
So, Bruce, is there any article of the original peace accord which is still in effect in Tajikistan?
No, I really can't think of any, and I agree with Nawruz wholeheartedly that this is, I mean, all of what was written down in the peace accord is gone. There's nothing left of that whatsoever. Certainly there's no power sharing in the government. We could just go right down the list of any of the things they agreed to, all gone. So, you know, it was at the time, I remember it was hailed as a major milestone. I remember when U.S.-led coalition started attacking Afghanistan and drove the Taliban from power, people suggested that the Tajik model might be a solution for Afghanistan. But now we look at the Tajik model 20 years after it was signed and see that it's totally nullified, and there is no trace of any of those agreements left.
Mm. So, Edward, what went wrong with this? Why it happened what it happened?
Well, I think, as we've already mentioned, you know, when Rahman first came to power in 1992, he was very, they called him the Rais of Rudaki, you know, Rudaki being the main thoroughfare through Dushanbe, you know, the idea being that he could only really control a few kilometers around himself. And as Bruce has said, it's remarkable that he's gone in 25 years from that sort of position to being sort of declared leader of the nation. And I think, you know, he's been, you know, as much as we can say bad things about him, he is a good strategic calculator and has managed to sort of outmaneuver most of his rivals. And obviously, due to this position of weakness, he had to sort of incorporate a number of warlords or commanders into the government, and, you know, also sort of sign this deal with the opposition, but has gradually managed to have these senior figures arrested, executed, exiled, and slowly but surely has managed to sort of renege on all of the promises made during the peace agreement. So I think it's a process by which sort of the slow consolidation of his power has resulted in him no longer needing to abide by conditions of the peace deal, as he sort of slowly dismantled the opposition.
I think, Nowruz, you touched upon this. There is no Islamic party anymore. Where the banning of this party falls in this agreement, and also what happened to the other allied parties in the accord? Who wants to take the question? Bruce, Nowruz, jump in.
So the other parties, like Mohammad Ruzi Iskandarov, he was the head of the Democratic Party of Tajikistan. That was one other party. And then there was also, you know, a socialist party. But really, after the peace agreement, the Democratic Party of Tajikistan and the Social Democratic Party, this another party that's currently led by, I know the deputy because I get to interview him, Shakir John, and then the Islamic Party. So these three parties, I mean, one of the things I noticed during my time as a researcher for the OSCE, you know, when I was like participated during the meetings about electoral reform, it was striking that these parties actually never got together, you know, in a sense, like you would expect them to kind of come to the rescue of each other in case, you know, one party got repressed by the government. So they were always kind of separate. So coordination and cooperation between these parties were almost non-existent. And I guess it's understandable because maybe, you know, the Democratic Party of Tajikistan and the Social Democratic Party of Tajikistan always portray themselves as secular in character, and then to gain more sufficient popular appeal, assuming that there were tremendous worries about the Islamic Party coming to power and imposing an Iranian-type political system, they always tried to avoid the Islamic Revival Party. On the other hand, the Islamic Revival Party never actually wanted to reach out. I guess it was too comfortable with its position as being, you know, authentic. Maybe they feared that they're going to, by reaching out to other parties, by cooperating with other parties, they might weaken their image. So it's one of the, you know, problems with establishing a democracy, you know, because for democracy to be established, all the opposition parties should unite. You know, attack on one party should be treated as attack on all the opposition parties. But that was never actually in the imagination of these political parties. It's like everyone was for itself, you know, like as a political unit. And I think that's, in my opinion, that's one of the fundamental problems of opposition parties in authoritarian countries. I mean, obviously, the government plays a huge role in playing this divide and rule game.
Okay, we are also reaching to the end of our program today, but talking about the legacy, Bruce, legacy of peace accord, the fact that there is no more trace of it in today's Tajikistan. So what has been its implication on overall society?
Well, it's provided a strange base for Rahman to promote his legitimacy for the country. You know, you've already read the paper that I wrote, and it's coming out pretty soon on the website. But I mean, it's whenever there's a problem in Tajikistan, and it seems like Rahman's credibility is at stake, or you know, before ahead of elections or something, they bring up this civil war. You know, and show graphic footage of what it was like and how horrible it was. Then they talk about the great things that Rahman's done. And so the implication here is that if you don't go for the status quo and vote for the government, you risk going back to this horrible stuff that you've just seen on TV, which was, you know, such a traumatic event for the whole country. So in some ways, the peace deal and the civil war are the basis for the legitimacy of Rahman's government 20 years after the deal was signed.
Okay, to end the discussion with this final point. So what was the greatest lesson from this war, from the legacy of it and its implication to Tajikistan? So let's start with you, Nowruz.
Well, the greatest lesson, obviously, as Bruce pointed out, I mean, there's Rahman, you know, tries to capitalize on it by showing these graphic footages. But I think it resonates with people now because, I mean, in the absence of any credible survey data, my hunch is that it's... people now tend to appreciate, especially the old generation, I would say, that any political dissent has terrible, terrible repercussions. Whether that's accurate or not, that's just, you know, the thinking now. So I think it has a chilling effect, like on freedoms. I guess that's one of the things. And then obviously the government plays a huge role in trying to portray the war as such, that, you know, this is pluralism actually brought the war, and therefore it's bad. and it's more likely to bring another war if, you know, we allow for dissent or opposition, and anyone who challenges the government is considered an extremist. It's interesting, like, you know, the war generally, you know, when you look at the comparative democratization literature, it's just the war tends to kind of usher in democratization. You know, democracy was created on the back of wars and contradictions, but in Tajikistan, it's just the other way around. You know, the war led to closure, and I think in addition to government, you know, manipulating the narrative, suggests that, you know, this larger environmental factors, like, you know, geopolitical factors, also play a role. I mean, right now, law and order and security tends to trump, you know, pluralism and democratization agenda, and then the government authoritarian regimes such as Tajikistan, you know, take advantage of that, you know, international discourse.
Okay, Edward, final point, please, on this lesson.
Yeah, to speak to Navruz's second point, I think it's, you know, the war, the peace-building process has sort of been paradoxical if we're taking a sort of liberal, we're basing our views on the assumptions of liberal peace, you know, this idea that the only way to build peace is through democracy and, you know, that you can create these sort of legal documents, power-sharing agreements, and that they will naturally lead to a sort of pluralism, you know, and I think the Tajik case has sort of shown that this in practice doesn't always work. You know, you can find other forms of peace that, you know, perhaps not as ideal as a democratic peace, but you can have some form of authoritarian peace where there is order and stability to some extent without having sort of pluralism. So I think the Tajik case is sort of speaks to that sort of model.
Okay, thank you very much for your insight, Dr. Edward Lemon, Tajikistan researcher and postdoctoral fellow at the Harriman Institute of University of Columbia, Dr. Nowruz Nekhbakhchoyev, visiting scholar at the Russian and Eastern European Institute at Indiana University, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's blog on Central Asia, for your time in Tats today.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.